towards you that's trying to talk louder.
Yes, I will speak up.
I'm dealing with a little something, so bear with me.
Today we're going to take a slightly, we're going to take a little detour. Today our topic is women of the Reformation. I don't know how I ended up with this topic. Because as my wife will tell you, women are a complete mystery to me.
Most of them.
Every time I think I have them kind of figured out, I realize I don't. All kidding aside, this has been an interesting endeavor. We're all aware of the phrase, behind every great man is a woman. Not sure, we don't know who coined that phrase, but I would like to modify it just a little bit. Behind every great man is an even greater woman. And I think we see that time and time again throughout history. We also have seen the flip side of the coin. Some women of lesser character have had tremendous influence over men in their lives, and not necessarily for good. So I think we know, just by experience and through history, that women are very influential. They have a very important place in society and in the lives of every person. So although history may not focus on women a lot, certainly in the time that we're looking at, they were not the leaders of the Reformation movement. But to think that they weren't influential or important would be a mistake. And so we want to take some time and just kind of look at some of the women, key figures in the Reformation. Now, the primary source material for this class is this little book, Reformation Women. It's very interesting. If you want to delve in more, this would be a good place to start. She chronicles 12 different women in the book. We're not going to attempt to look at 12. I think I have picked 5. And I may end up with a lot of extra time at the end, so I have something in my back pocket if we do. And I tried to pick some women that maybe you aren't aware of. So with a little trepidation, I want to ask, because I know as soon as I do, you're going to say a name I've never heard of. Do you know? Do you have any names of any women that were prominent or influential or significant in the Protestant Reformation?
Luther's wife.
Yeah. I don't remember her name in its entirety.
Catherine von Born?
Yeah. That's it. Very good. A plus. Yeah, so you're right where I was.
There was a queen in England who, or not England, but in France, who was friendly to the Reformation. She was a Christian, not a Catholic.
Yes.
And I can't tell you her name.
Yeah, and we're somewhat aware of some of the British monarchs. Queen Elizabeth I was a friend to the Reformation. There were some British monarchs who were not friends to the Reformation. But yeah, so we can't pull their names off the top of our heads like we would if you were to ask who were some of the great theologians of the Reformation. So let's just take some time and look at some little biographical sketches of some women here in the Reformation. We'll look at three. The first three are all very similar in that they held a similar role, if you will. They were all wives of some of the key reformers. So I already mentioned Luther's woman. She's not one that we'll look at. And then the last two are a bit different, as they were actually members of European royalty, and eventually were queens, princesses and then queens of various European countries. So they have a little bit different twist to their stories. But with that, the first lady that we'll look at is named Anna Reinhardt. She would become Anna Zwingli. She was the wife of a Swiss reformer, Zwingli. We know nothing, really, about her early years. They're not even sure when she was born. Scholars have settled on around 1484. I think she was probably born. She was born in a middle-class family. Her father was a middle-class landlord. So she was educated to a level that a lot of people weren't because of her father's economic status. Now, she'll become known as the Reformation's weeping mother, and we'll look and find out why that is here in a minute. But when she met and married Zwingli, she was a widow. She had married before in 1522 a man named John, who joined the Swiss army and was engaged in various military campaigns and did not die in battle, but died fairly young as a result of his military service. And they had two children, the first of which died in infancy. And that's going to be a common theme as we go through this study, or through this today. Almost all of these families suffered the loss of a child at a very young age. During the Middle Ages in Europe, infant mortality rates were as high as 30%. Somewhere between 20 and 30%. Now, you compare that to infant mortality rate in the U.S. right now is 0.5%. So it's a significant difference. That's another aspect of these people's lives that I think we want to try to keep in mind. Life was hard during the Reformation. It's not like it is now. If you live to be 70, you were a Methuselah, and you were really old if you lived to be 70. Disease was basically unchecked. Typhus, the Black Plague, measles, dysentery, and so plagues were coming through with great regularity, killing lots of people. Poverty was nothing like, it was far beyond what we can even imagine today living here. So it was a tough, a very difficult time to live. Life was hard. So just keep that in mind as we go through and talk about these women. So in 1522, I think I said that already before, I was wrong. Her first marriage was before that. In 1522 is when she ended up marrying Ulrich Zwingli. Now he was, at the time, he was still was a Catholic priest. And so they married in secret because it was absolutely forbidden for Catholic priests to marry. A couple of years later, they made it publicly known that they were married, and so it was somewhat, I don't want to say scandalous, but it was a big deal. And Zwingli was the first of the Protestant reformers to actually marry. And so just by that fact, Anna kind of stepped into a pretty significant role. Everybody was looking at her. Everybody was watching her. Everybody was looking at this marriage to see what was this going to be like. This was new, clergy marrying. And approvedly so. It was happening. It had been happening kind of in secret, off and on. It was part of the corruptions that we've talked about in the Catholic priesthood. Not that the activity itself was necessarily wrong, but they were just violating their own doctrines right and left. So this relationship was somewhat under a microscope of the people. And so because of that, she and they served really as a great role model for what a marriage should be like, especially for someone in the clergy. So I don't know, we don't know that she felt any unique pressures from this, but I can imagine she probably did. As I mentioned, she had two children. The first one died. The second child, her son, must have been a noticeably bright child, because he's the one that really brought her and Zwingli together. She was a member of his parish. She was a widow. She didn't have great means or the ability to produce a lot of income because of the economic structures of the day. And so he would meet with her with regularity because of her situation. But he really noticed her son and appreciated the boy's potential. So he really began to invest himself into the son's life. And of course, that brought he and Anna together quite a bit. And eventually they fell in love and got married. Yes, we talked about that. One thing we'll see with Anna, and even more so with the other two, was a role they played, I won't say pastoral ministry because they weren't pastors, but they had that kind of role in their church and in the community. And to some degree, and in some ways to an even greater degree than their husbands did, because their husbands were rather busy preaching, teaching, writing, and all of that. And, you know, they did engage in pastoral ministry quite a bit. Sometimes we see them only as, you know, academic theologians, but they weren't. They were pastors at heart. So they did engage in that quite a bit, but their wives were right there alongside of them, and in some ways even ahead of them in that regard. Anna spent a lot of time and effort ministering to the poor and to the sick in their community. And that's one reason why she kind of became and was looked at as a mother figure. Again, when we say that today, we have this picture in our mind. But when we say ministering to the poor and the sick in Zurich in the Middle Ages, that's at a whole different magnitude. There were lots of poor, and there were lots of sick. The need was tremendous. It was huge. And this is another aspect to the importance of the role that these women played. The Reformation, in a big way, was started because of corruption in the Catholic Church. And one aspect of that corruption is that many of the priests didn't even believe Catholic doctrine. They weren't serious. They were a cavalier in their duties, and they were abusing their duties. They basically were not sincere at all in what they were doing. And now you have this Reformation movement. And so I think one big question that needed to be answered was, is this sincere? Is this real? Are the people involved in this movement true? And I think these women demonstrated that the change that the Reformation promised was real, because they were living it out day to day to day in their service to the church and to their community. Now, her home became what you could call a Reformation hub. Zwingli would entertain other reformers would come, and he would put them up in his home, and where they would discuss things of doctrine and other issues. Also, at that time in Europe, as you know, because of the counter-reformation efforts, there were wars and conflicts everywhere, all the time. And so Protestants were being run out of their home countries, right and left. People were fleeing for their lives. And so refugees were flooding into particularly Switzerland. It was a safe haven, and Zurich was one of the places that refugees would flee. So there were large numbers of refugees that needed care and attention. And the Zwinglis would put many of them up in their home for long periods of time. And she would provide care. She would provide room and board for them. And as we look at some of these others, I can give you a better feel for what that might have looked like. See here. She also was a fierce defender of her husband. Because of the persecution that I just mentioned, all of these leading reformers, I won't say they were fearful, but they were concerned at some degree about their safety. Their lives were threatened all the time. And so Zwingli and the others, they lived in constant threat of assassination. You know, Luther was spirited off in secret and hidden away in a castle for some period of time because he probably would have been dead otherwise. So Anna, anytime Zwingli had to go out at night, she would make sure she found somebody that could accompany him and go with him. If he was kept at work late, she would make sure somebody was there that could accompany him home. So she was the one who was active in making sure that Zwingli had somebody around him at all times to protect him. And so they credit her on more than one occasion of foiling certain attempts on Zwingli's life because he wasn't alone. So that was very important to her, and she was very aggressive in that way, protecting her husband. She wasn't a theologian by any means, but she was a believer. She was a Protestant. She was a Reformed believer. But she was highly interested in theology, and so she loved to sit and just listen to Zwingli explain things to her. And when Zwingli and some others were working on the Swiss-German translation of the Bible, he would read to her every night the proof texts of what they had been working on. And she really, really enjoyed that. That was very important to her. This is one of the really true love stories. I'm sure there were many. But theirs was a real love story. They really had a deep love one for another. Now, in October of 1531, as a part of the Counter-Reformation, the Roman Catholic Church raised an army of 7,000, and that army was advancing on Zurich. And when they heard about it, they quickly tried to throw together an army, but they could only manage an army of 2,000. And Zwingli went along as the chaplain for the army, and of course they were slaughtered. It was a complete massacre, and Zwingli was killed. But along with Zwingli, Anna's son was killed, and her brother-in-law was killed. So in a day, she lost a lot of people that she had really cared about. But when, before Zwingli left, Anna is credited as saying to him, "We shall see each other again if the Lord wills, his will be done. And what will you bring back when you come?" And Zwingli replied, "Blessing after dark night." And even though she was grieved deeply by his loss, those last words gave her hope, because she saw the blessing after the dark night being what was to come when she would see him again in the light of heaven. So she stayed strong in her faith despite the great loss that she had endured. Now she was widowed again, and you know, older now at the time. But Heinrich Bullinger, who ended up succeeding Zwingli there at Zurich, he started in Zurich. That's where he grew up. That's where he was ordained. So he knew Zwingli. They were good friends. Bullinger admired Zwingli a lot. And so Bullinger steps in and basically fulfills the role of a son on behalf of Anna and promised to take care of her. So he and his wife take Anna into their household, and he provides all of her financial support until the day she dies. Zwingli had left her no money. She had nothing afterwards. They literally used every dime they had just to live for themselves and in their ministry to help the poor and the sick. He had nothing left. So she was in dire straits, except for the providence of God, who provided for her through Bullinger and his wife. Bullinger is credited with saying to Anna, "You shall not want, dear mother. I will remain your friend, your teacher, and your advisor." And after she died, he's credited with saying, "I desire no more happy end of life. She passed away softly like a mild light and went home to her Lord, worshiping and commending us all to God." So Anna, I think her legacy would be one of being a great helpmate to her husband, a great and compassionate friend to the community, and a dedicated servant to the Lord, and a great role model for not only all marriages, but particularly at the time for marriages between this new endeavor of pastors and preachers getting married. Any questions or comments about Anna? All right. Well, the second, we're going to look at another Anna. So apparently only reformers would only marry ladies named Anna, I guess.
Only John's.
Yeah. Next, we're going to look at Anna Aldischweiler.
Yeah.
Say that fast. I don't even know if I'm saying it right. Adlisweiler. Now, she earned the nickname the Mother of Zurich. This Anna is the wife of Bullinger, who succeeds Zwingli there in Zurich. She was born in 1504. We do know a little bit more about her childhood. We don't know if it's different than the other Annas, because we don't know anything about her childhood. But this Anna's childhood was a hard one, which I think was not uncommon at the time. Her dad died in battle when she was only 8, so at a pretty early age she was without a father, and her mother was ill. She was just a sickly woman. And so when Anna's mother became a widow with a child, and she's not well, she decides to put Anna in the convent. And so she does, and Anna ends up becoming a nun. But the convents at the day often served as hospitals, so Anna's mother lived with her in the convent, and she received her medical care there. So unusual for nuns, Anna was able to maintain a pretty close relationship and contact with her mother because they were both there in the convent. Anna serving as a nun, her mom being treated for her illnesses. In 1522, this was the year that Zwingli married the other Anna, the Zurich City Council had decided that they would allow the nuns to leave the convent if they so chose. They could stay if they wanted, they could leave if they wanted. Well, many of the nuns left because they were still committed Roman Catholics. Zurich was Protestant. So many of the nuns left. Anna decided to stay. One reason was because of her ill mother. She decided to stay there in the convent because her mother was there receiving medical care. So she stayed. Now, at the time, Zwingli was the lead reformer in Zurich, but Bullinger was there under his tutelage, and Bullinger visited the convent on a couple of occasions, and that's when he met Anna. He met her at the convent on one of his visits, and so they developed a relationship, and over time they fell in love, and he proposed marriage. But her mother was opposed to the marriage, not sure why. We don't know why, but she was not in favor of it. Bullinger actually went to the city council to argue for his legal right to marry her. But Anna decided to postpone their marriage in honor of her mother's wishes. And so they did not marry until her mother actually passed away. Once her mother died, then they married in 1529. I'm not sure exactly what year he proposed to her, so I'm not sure how long they had to wait. But I think that speaks something of Anna's character, that she wanted to honor her mother in that way and put her own desires on hold there. And Heinrich was eventually ordained as a minister, and then he was called to be pastor in Bremgarten. And so they move to Bremgarten, and he ministers there. And then in 1531, after Zwingli died, if you remember, it's a war, it's a battle. So the Roman Catholic army comes down. They destroy the defenses of Zurich. And so portions of Switzerland then are forced to re-Catholicize. Switzerland, like a lot of places in Europe, was not a single unified country. It was kind of a loose conglomeration of states. So it'd be like the United States, but all the states are completely independent, but we have some kind of loose arrangement. So some of the states and cities were forced to re-Catholicize. Others were given the option to choose. It's kind of a weird arrangement, but anyway, where Bullinger was in Bremgarten, they were forced to re-Catholicize. So all of a sudden, he's without a job. But Zurich is in need of a pastor now. And so Zurich, the city council of Zurich, extends a call to Bullinger to come and replace Zwingli there in Zurich. And so he does. And so they move back to Zurich in 1531. So, like Anna Zwingli, Anna Bullinger fills a very similar role. One big difference is the Boulangers have 11 children. 11. So she's got enough on her hands to take care of. Plus, Boulanger's parents lived with her. Plus, they took on Zwingli's widow, and they were taking care of her. But Boulanger was he had a big heart for people, and he opened his home. Students that were in theological study, he had a habit of inviting them to come and live with them, and he would even provide financial support for their education and their room and board. I mean, they would come live with him, and they were like his kids. He was providing their financial support. Like Zwingli, visiting reformers, they came and stayed with the Boulangers. People fleeing religious persecution, they put them up in their home. There was one event where 150 men were driven out of their home, you know, this conflict that was everywhere, and they fled to Zurich. They were refugees. And Boulanger put up 80. 80 of these 150 lived with them in their house for a period of time. I can't even imagine. There was an Italian scholar who had stayed with the Boulangers at one point, and he wrote, he's credited with saying, "Your friendliness and your Christian care for us during our stay with you obliges me to give you my inmost thanks. Greet for us very heartily your wife, who showed herself so full of kindly service and love." And this was a common thing. A lot of the people that ended up staying with these reformers and were under the care of their wives would consistently write back and thank them, and specifically mention the care that they had received from their wives.
Scott?
Yeah.
That's absolutely amazing to figure out how in the world they had the resources, how God provided the resources to take care of that many people.
Mind-boggling. If Sam said it once last week, he said it 50 times. Just God's providential care. I mean, God's hand was at work. God had a purpose. He had a plan. He was in control, and so things worked out. I mean, it just worked out.
Scott, where did they live? They could put up some. I mean, did they move to the convent?
You know, I don't know. Well, so yeah, I guess you know. So these were previously Catholic churches. And the Catholic Church had its, what do they call it? Where the priests would stay. And so I think that was where these Reformed pastors were living.
Okay, so they took over the larger building. So they weren't just in some 1520s house. They were in a...
Yeah, I mean, I can't say that, but don't quote me on that. But, I think it had to be something like that, right? She was so well known for her care and her generosity and her kindness that Queen Elizabeth I sent her an ornamental goblet to her to express her thanks for how they cared for Protestants, particularly refugees, you know, many of which fled England under the reign of Elizabeth's half-sister, Bloody Mary. So these women became well-known not just in the towns where they served, but across the Reformation, where the Reformation spread, news about them spread as well. In 1564, there was one of those outbreaks of the plague. People sick, dying. I don't know if you remember the Monty Python. Yeah. In Search of the Holy Grail, there's a one scene where the guy's going through with the wheelbarrow, crying, "Bring out your dead," and they're just bringing these people out and throwing them on the wheelbarrow. I mean, those people were dying like, like crazy. Anna served as a nurse. She nursed Heinrich back from the ill, and she attended to many who were dying or suffering from disease. And then when she died, I think she actually got sick caring for these others and ended up dying in 1564, and Heinrich mourned her loss. It's quoted as saying, he mourned his loyal, chosen, and exquisitely godly wife. And she earned, or they, people called her the mother of Zurich because of her care. Any questions about Anna number two?
I'm impressed. Mostly history treats marriage as transactional, and we're seeing just a lot of love and devotion here.
Yeah.
You would think that an older man who's lost his wife would pick a younger woman because she's stronger and she can have lots more children, but that wasn't necessarily happening. They were picking based on respect and value and maybe believing that.
Yeah, well, in both of these cases, these men got to know these women and fell in love with them.
Yeah.
And married them because of that. Yeah. There's nothing more to it than that. They weren't, playing some angle. Doesn't appear. And that was really important because that was one of the big, well, we'll see that with this next woman. This marrying of the priests and was a big deal. I don't know that we quite understand how big of a deal it was, but we'll maybe get a little bit of insight with.
When did you say Zwingli's wife had died?
She died in Zwingli's. Zwingli's wife died in 1538.
Okay.
All right, so we're going to break the mold here. The next reformer's wife, Katharina Schütz. Katharina Schütz. Now, she ends up marrying, I guess for us, is a lesser known reformer, Matthew Zell. And they were in Strasbourg, Germany. Now, Katharina was born in 1497. She was also born into the middle class. Her dad was a middle class, artisan family. As a result, she also was very well educated. And she lived to be fairly old. She lived to be 64. She was, of course, all these people were raised Roman Catholic. But she, maybe kind of like Luther, sort of, she exhibited at a very young age really a high degree of religious sensitivity. She was a very religious person. It was something that was of interest and importance to her, even as a young person. And she even made a vow of chastity as a young person, because in the Roman Catholic scheme, that was seen as something that would earn you brownie points. seen to be a holy way of life, and you could receive an extra dispensation of grace and all that. However, like Luther, she really struggled with assurance of salvation. She never felt assured. And so, like Luther, she was working hard. She was constantly engaged in doing the things that you had to do to gain and maintain her salvation. So she was a lot like Luther in that day. Like I said, now Matthew Zell was in Strasbourg, and he was one of several, there were several churches in Strasbourg, and he was one of several reformers who were there. Martin Bucer was a contemporary of his there in Strasbourg. They knew each other quite well, obviously. In 1518, Zell takes over the pastorate at the cathedral there in Strasbourg. The big, you know, all those towns would have at least one, you know, big cathedral. And he took over the pastorate of the cathedral. But, you know, Martin Luther was there in Germany too. So pretty quickly after that, Zell started warming up to the ideas that Luther was espousing, and he began to voice his support for Luther and Luther's doctrine, which put him crossways with the Catholic Church, which he was a part of. And so the bishop there forbid him from entering the pulpit. And back then, the pulpits were way up, right? They climbed these stairs to actually get up on the pulpit. They actually locked the gate to the pulpit so he couldn't get up there and preach. Well, Zell and some of his buddies built themselves this little wooden portable pulpit that he would carry into the church, and he would climb up on that, and he would just continue preaching. So he's like, you know, to the bishop. But he was pretty quickly accused and labeled a heretic. But didn't end up going anywhere. But Katerina was one of the members of his parish, and so she sat under his preaching and tutelage for some time, and she became convinced of the truths of the gospel as being presented, and she converted to Protestantism under his tutelage, and she found the assurance that she had struggled so hard to find. She found the assurance in the gospel of Christ. So all the energy that she had been putting into trying to maintain and maintain her salvation, she just redirected to her community, really. The author of the book said that she proved to be a very pious, busy, discreet wife, fully supporting her family. So that's a description that could be made of all three of these women. Now, Zwingli, who knew her, knew them, said of her that she combines the graces of both Mary and Martha. So he saw her as a kind of a complete woman in her character and in her worship and in the diligence of her service. Now, like I said, she was very well educated. She was married to a reformer, so she became extremely knowledgeable in the doctrines of the Reformation. And she had maybe a stronger desire than the other two to be more overtly active in the spreading of the gospel. And she was very bold. And in many ways, she even eclipsed her husband, Zell, in that way. In fact, Bucer said that Zell was ruled by his wife, who was a trifle imperious. Which means she kind of assumes some authority that she really hadn't been given. She was very active in spreading, in being a part of the spreading of the gospel. But Bucer was also said that she was a God-fearing, and she was as God-fearing and courageous as a hero. So she was something else. But she said that she did she had no interest in being in a lead role. She said she wanted to be her husband's helper, a little piece of the rib of the sainted Matthew Zell. So she didn't have any interest in stepping out of her role as a wife. But at the same time, she had this compelling desire to be to spread the gospel. So she actually wrote quite a bit. She did a lot of writing and a lot of writing on theological matters, some of which were published. One of the first things she wrote, and maybe one of the most significant, was she wrote a defense of clerical marriage. She wanted to show from Scripture why priests and pastors have the right to marry, and that celibacy is not morally superior to marriage. So this, again, this kind of highlights it. This was a big deal that these guys were getting married, and I think in the grand scheme of things, it was very important how those marriages played themselves out in the public space. And again, all this is under the providential workings of God. She also communicated a lot with other reformers. She corresponded a lot via the mail with both with reformers like Luther and Zwingli. A lot. I mean, the term the author used was prolific. So she was writing back and forth with these men a lot, and I'm sure they were. She's, you know, kicking ideas back and forth about, you know, Reformed doctrine, asking questions, or answering her questions. She's sharing her thoughts. But she was also, like the others, very busy in her community, caring for the sick, needy, and the Protestant refugees that fled from persecution. Strasbourg was another one of those safe havens for refugees. Zurich, Strasbourg, Geneva, those places were places people fled. A very similar situation as the first Anna. A bunch of refugees flood into Strasbourg, and the Zells take on, I know, like 50 of them. I mean, not the Zells. The Zells take on like 50 of them, and they're living in their house for 4 weeks. But she also wrote a letter to the wives of these 50 or 60 men that are living in her house, encouraging them to stand firm in the faith because they were left behind. The men fled. The wives stayed there with their children in the homes, which I'm sure was pretty scary for them. So she wrote them a letter to help, you know, encouraging them to stand firm. And then she also shared with them that a woman's role of staying at home with children was an active service to Christ, not a default or passive position. So here she's kind of stepping into this a teaching role in a way. In 1525, the Peasants' War breaks out. That's was a peasant uprising in Germany, and it turned violent, and then was aggressively and massively put down by the aristocracy. Tens of thousands of people died, some estimates as many as 100,000. And unfortunately, the Reformation was kind of co-opted, which happened in a couple of different instances, as support for this effort. There was at least one, maybe there were a couple of reformers that were kind of off the rails a little bit and kind of a social gospel kind of aspect to their ministries, and they were encouraging this kind of social and political upheaval. Luther and the others rejected that, but Katerina and Matthew Zell, they both would visit these peasant camps and really encourage and would plead with the people, don't do this. Don't get engaged in this conflict. But their pleadings were not heeded, and thousands of people died. But that is an example of her heart. Calvin, when he was run out of France, he stayed with the Zells as he was passing through. When Luther debated Zwingli in Marburg, that brought a lot of reformers kind of to the area. And many of them stayed with the Zells in their house. And Anna is quoted as saying, I have been 14 days made and cooked. She also regularly visited the prisons. She had a heart for prisoners, men who were on death row. She wanted to go there to encourage them, minister to them, preach the gospel to them. So she did that a lot. Although they had 11 children, they lost two in infancy or really, really young. And so that was a burden that she bore. But that, those kinds of things, especially in the lives of these women, it didn't slow them down at all in their service. It didn't stop them at all. It didn't derail them. They dealt with it, but continued to faithfully minister in the way that they felt God had called them to minister. Now, her husband, Matthew, was more inclined to quietness. He wasn't as bold as she was. And so he tended not to get involved in some of the disputes that were arising within Protestantism on various issues of theology. But Catherine was not quiet about it. And she wrote Luther one time. And she pleaded with Luther. She asked him to treat the Swiss with a little more mildness in the controversy about the Lord's Supper. Well, Luther wrote her back. But what was unique about that was that his reply to her was much more polite than was common to Luther. So you can see, yeah, Luther must have had a higher deal of respect and regard for Katerina. In 1541, Strasbourg's hit with a plague. And Anna's right in there, or Katerina's right in there, ministering to the sick, even to her husband Matthew, who got sick, nursed him back to health. In 1558, one of the city magistrates got leprosy. The city council refused anybody to visit him. You know, he's got leprosy. It's highly contagious. You know, bad luck for him, but. Somehow Katerina got permission to visit him, and she would visit him regularly to encourage him in his affliction. She had a nephew that contracted syphilis, and he was sent to a hospital that specialized in treating syphilis. Well, she went and lived with him in the hospital for a period of time so that she could provide care for him, a level of care that he wasn't getting at the hospital. So I think it's clear that Katerina and the other two, they saw a clear calling to serve, and they were obedient. They were undeniably obedient to their calling, fearless in their obedience. But after, so Matthew Zell dies, Booser ends up leaving and going to England. And I am almost out of time. Wow. It's gone fast. That's all right. Strasbourg changes. Lutheranism moves in and kind of takes over Strasbourg. And the guy that succeeded Zell there at the cathedral is preaching doctrines that aren't in line with the Reformation doctrine, and he's calling for a high form of Lutheranism, and kind of in that process, he kind of tramples on Matthew Zell's reputation a little bit, and Katerina wouldn't have nothing of it. And she, his name was Rabus, she wrote one of her most notable works. It was a defense of truth, of the truth of the Reformation, and it was very public. And the very public nature of her letter was therefore fairly controversial and kind of put her into the role of a reformer in a way. In fact, she's referred to by many historians as a lay reformer. Well, Rabus responds and is not kind in his response to her. And in fact, he calls her a disturber of the peace of the church. So she responds, again, to a letter that is sent to the entire citizenship of Strasbourg, and this is what she says. "Do you call this disturbing the peace, that instead of spending my time in frivolous amusements, I have visited the plague-infested and carried out the dead? I have visited those in prison and under sentence of death. Often for 3 days and nights I have neither eaten nor slept. I have never mounted the pulpit, but I have done more than any minister in visiting those in ministry. Is this disturbing the peace of the church? You young fellows tread on the graves of the first fathers of the church in Strasbourg and punish all who disagree with you. But faith cannot be forced." So this gal was tough. She published a commentary on Psalms 51 and 130. Later. And as another example of her her kindness and her generosity and her self sacrifice, when Bucer left for England, he gave her 2 gold coins that she could use in the support of the poor and refugees. Well, she took one of those coins. I don't know if she physically divided it or how she did it, but one of the coins, she gave half of its value to a persecuted minister who had 5 kids, and she gave the other half to a pastor's wife who had seen her husband beheaded. The other coin she gave back to Bucer because she thought he might need it when he goes to England. So another wonderful example of these women. I had 2 other women that we're not going to get to. But just quickly, I think there are a few things that we can learn from their example, and this is really, I think, the most important part of this whole lesson, this whole, I think this is particularly important to us today. All of these women shared certain things in common, and one of those is that they had an overriding spiritual identity. Their identity was not in what they did. Their identity was not in, "I'm a housewife," "I'm a mother," or flip the coin for a man, you know, "I'm a accountant," "I'm a father." You know, obviously they were those things, but they had a spiritual identity, that they were Reformed Christians. They were God's children. That identity overrode everything else. So the importance that is, the danger that is, if you identify as a wife and your husband dies and all of a sudden you're a widow, you know, your world is, I mean, all of a sudden, what do you do? I'm not who I was. Or if your identity is your job and you find out you're laid off, you know, those are just circumstances. But their identity was this. And so despite changes in circumstance, often significant, they could continue living an obedient life of service, because their identity was this, and these other things were like little sub-identities that didn't, that were controlled by this overriding identity. So I think that's something that we ought to think about. You know, where are we really, how do we really identify ourselves? Another common thing, I think, real quickly, everyone has gifts and everyone needs to use them. And so the point is not, can you feed dozens of refugees for a week? Can you write theological treatises to the other women that we didn't get to? Can you lead armies? You know, each of us has gifts that we can use wherever God has put us, and we should use them. Another one, good leadership is servanthood. Their leadership was effective, it was powerful, because they served sacrificially. Their energy was poured, their time and energy they constantly poured into other people, and that creates a trust. It creates a very powerful trust, and then enables your leadership then to mean something, to be effective. If people don't trust you, they're not going to follow. One other thing I think that we can learn, and this is related to the identity. Radical change in circumstances did not stop their fruitfulness. It didn't matter what happened to them or how significant. They continued to serve. There's a little saying, bloom where you're planted. Well, wherever they ended up being planted, they just bloomed. I mean, they just served. And maybe they had to do something different. Maybe they used to serve this way. Now they serve this way. Any questions or comments before I let y'all go? 5 minutes late, as always.
The name of that book?
Reformation Women by Rebecca Van Dudevard. Very interesting book.
I think that I was going to say that when you put your focus on Christ and, you know, God's word, and you have that identity, that's your main identity. And then, like you said, all these other things, they're not going to affect you. They're not as significant as this identity, right? I've lost this identity, but it's okay. I still know who I am and who I belong to.
Yeah.
And I'm serving that way.
It goes a long way to completely being derailed. Mm-hmm. You know, your train doesn't just completely leave the track.
Yeah.
These women and these people in this very difficult time, really remarkable. I think we have a lot that we can learn from them. I think it's a truism to say that where the church is persecuted, it grows stronger. I think the opposite, probably a truism as well, where the church has it easy, it grows weak. And we've had it easy here for a long time. And I'll be the first to say, it's weakened me. I read these and I'm like, wow. Wow. That's inspiring. So I think for us, we need to be even more thoughtful about these things, because the environment we're in does not encourage it. It discourages it. Alright, let me pray real quick and let y'all go. Dear Heavenly Father, we love you. Thank you for these wonderful examples of a godly Christian living. These women who look to you for everything. And their hearts were driven by compassion to serve you the way that you had served us. You said you came to serve. And they wanted to be like you. These women exhibited a level of Christ-likeness that is encouraging to us. And I just pray that you'd help us to dwell on these things throughout the week. And may we aspire to follow you with the earnestness that they did. And it's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.